As the court has noted, my name is Perry H. Hill, and I practice in Martinsville, Virginia. And this morning I'm here with regard to the case of Leroy Ellis versus Commonwealth of Virginia. This issue is, in my viewpoint, not a really complex issue. It's a one-issue appeal. This case involves a gentleman who pled guilty pursuant to an Alford plea. And I think the fact that he pled guilty pursuant to an Alford plea is important in this particular case.
What offense did he plead guilty to?
Receiving stolen property, if you will, Your Honor, involving a stolen television set.
Well, I looked at the indictment, and yes? Television is not referenced in the amended indictment. Sometimes they say to wit, and it'll list specific property, but this particular indictment makes no listing, nor, to follow up on Judge Petty's question, I don't recall there being any evidence of any sort of bill of particulars being filed in this case. Was there?
I don't think that there was.
So, given that, where's the, when he pleads guilty to an offense that generally refers to unnamed items, how do we discern whether the trial court erred or not in saying selecting a particular amount of restitution as being unsupported by the evidence?
Well, I looked at that order granting a motion to amend indictment, and it also says that he was in possession of these stolen items, it's in the plural, back on February the 26th, 2015. Now, that's the actual date that these offenses occurred, that these items ended up being stolen.
Right.
And I would suggest, Judge,
that's
that,
what he pleaded guilty to, isn't it?
He did plead guilty to that. Now, at the time that we pled guilty, I think it was clear to the court that what our intent was to plead guilty to the charge of receiving stolen property.
Well, there was a proffer made by the Commonwealth, was there not, that what he was pleading guilty to was being in possession of the stolen TV?
That's exactly right, Judge. And then I note that the Commonwealth, in her petition, or brief for the Commonwealth, wrote that by pleading guilty or adding this guilty plea meant that he was pleading guilty to the whole nine yards, all of the items that were stolen. In fact, if I remember correctly, the Commonwealth wrote in this brief that, to the contrary, the proffer, which was accepted by the trial court without objection, included a list of multiple items that had been stolen: a Glock handgun, a flat-screen TV, two watches, and an Xbox game system. Now, no, we did not object to that proffer because we think that's correct. Those items were stolen. But because they were stolen, obviously does not mean that Mr. Ellis is the one that stole them. All we said was that he was pleading guilty because he knew the evidence that was against him, i.e. the fact that the flat-screen TV was found in his apartment, but at the same time, we never intended to plead guilty to all these charges.
Well, there's no legal significance between a guilty plea pursuant to Alford and a guilty plea straight up.
Well, no legal significance, Your Honor. I had thought that North Carolina versus Alford stood for the proposition if a client did not want to flat out say, I'm guilty, because he feels he's not guilty, the Alford plea is an alternative to that.
Alford versus North Carolina simply says there's no constitutional violation when a defendant pleads guilty without admitting his guilt.
Well, so without admitting his guilt. And that's what we're doing.
He didn't admit his guilt, but there's no legal significance between the two. It's a guilt. There's only three pleas in Virginia: guilty, not guilty, and nolle contendere.
I understand, Your Honor. But when he pleads guilty pursuant to an Alford plea,
when you plead guilty, period, whether it's an Alford plea or not,
guilty.
Pleading guilty, you're admitting,
it's
a judicial admission that you're not contesting any of the evidence that's reflected in the indictment.
Can you take it?
The charge reflected in the indictment.
Can you take it all the way to say because he's pleading guilty, not necessarily pursuant to a pleading?
All I'm saying is I'm agreeing with Judge Petty that North Carolina versus Alford doesn't provide for a hybrid plea. It simply says, what happened in North Carolina against Alford is the defendant refused to admit that he was guilty, and the trial court refused to accept his guilty plea. And the United States Supreme Court said that's error, that a defendant can plead guilty if he thinks it's in his best interest to do so upon the advice of counsel, without you know, necessarily admitting that he has done those things which he's accused of in the indictment. So the legal effect is as if you had pleaded guilty or been found guilty. It's a guilty verdict for something that's charged in the indictment.
Oh, I agree with that, Your Honor. It is a guilty plea for anything that's charged in the indictment. I agree with the court's assessment. I agree with what His Honor Judge Petty said. But does that mean because he pleads guilty to a charge when the proffer is he's pleading guilty to receiving a stolen television set, does that mean it carries all the way over to say I'm pleading guilty to stealing the Glock handgun,
well, now
the
that's
two
a good,
watches?
That's a good question. It's one I'm sure we're going to put to Mr. Jeffrey when he gets up there. But because we've got on the one hand the indictment, which, as you've pointed out, reflects, you know, plural items that he's pleading guilty to without any specificity. And we have the Commonwealth's proffer, which you assert, you know, while it notes that a lot of items were stolen, specifically only alleges that he was in possession of the television set. And the question is, what legal effect does that have on the restitution order?
Well, I think here, and I would like the court to note that originally the victim, in this case, Mr. Kidd, he had originally sought restitution totaling almost $3,000. Of that amount, he had $1,500 in there, which was supposed to be for his moving expenses. Now, what the court did was, and this was pointed out by the Commonwealth in their brief, what the court did was they subtracted $600 from that $1,500 in moving expenses, and then said they did not feel that these moving expenses were part of this particular case, reimbursable losses. And then they said, well, in fact, at the time that this occurred, I asked the judge, well, why are you making him pay the full $1,500? The only thing that we pled guilty to was the receiving stolen property. That TV was, in fact, recovered.
Did the Commonwealth include in its plea agreement anything about restitution?
I don't believe that the Commonwealth did. Now, that's probably an oversight on my part, because I simply assumed if we got to restitution.
Do you agree that the Commonwealth could have required restitution for all the items stolen as a part of the plea agreement?
Yes, but they did not. I know that for a fact.
And I noticed that in looking at the proffer, the only reference to any value in the proffer by the Commonwealth is Mr. Ellis stated he bought the TV for $250. So I guess that's the only thing that the Commonwealth has offered in terms of value of any items involved in the offense.
And I think what the Commonwealth is saying in this particular instance is because he entered that plea, i.e. the Alford plea, and we've already discussed that, that means the court could infer or conclude that he's guilty of the whole ball of wax. He stole all this property. And I don't know that the court can make that leap from saying, well, look, you found the TV in my house. I admit that. It was there. I'm not saying that I knew it was stolen. I'm pleading. I'm not admitting my guilt. It's an alpha plea. Now, how do you go all the way to the next step and say, well, because you did that, we're going to make you pay for the whole ball of wax, the $1,500? I do not agree with that, and I think that this argument by the Commonwealth to suggest that pursuant to this plea, let's just call it a guilty plea because that's essentially what it was. It therefore makes him liable for all the items that were stolen from the property, even though he never pled guilty to those charges involving that property. I'd like to reserve my remainder of time to rebut the Commonwealth, if I may, Your Honor.
That would be fine. Mr. Jeffries.
Good morning. May it please the court. Donald Jeffrey from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Commonwealth. Just at the outset, I would note that, as the court pointed out, there isn't any legal significance in this case with respect to the Alford plea. I would also note that on page 189 of the appendix in this case, for what it's worth factually, that the defendant was actually asked if he understood that the effect of the plea was the same as a plea of guilty, and he responded affirmatively.
Well, Mr. Jeff, let's turn from the record to the statutes involved. 19.2-303 says that the court may require the defendant to make partial restitution to the aggrieved party or parties for damages or loss caused by the offense for which convicted. And 305 also said, caused by the offense for which conviction was had. Now, he was convicted of receiving stolen property. The elements of that offense, and I just point to the model jury instruction as a very basic, the first element of that offense is that the goods were previously stolen from the victim by some other person. So he pled guilty to an offense that by its definition means he wasn't the thief. How in the world can the court impose restitution on him for the larceny of the other property stolen by someone else?
Well, I don't have the statute in front of me, Judge Petty. I'm not sure the statute has that language in it. I think it's a practical matter. And if it does, I
had to go back a ways to... I had to go back a ways to find the a case that said that, too. Here it is, Gillen versus Commonwealth, which is a 1945 Supreme Court case. And it says, in Hay versus Commonwealth, Judge Burke, Sr., clearly stated the applicable rule of law when he stated, to convict an offender against this statute, four things must be proved. One, that the goods or other things were previously stolen by some other person. So that seems to be the element of the offense.
Of course, you know, this is a self-supplied conviction, first of all, and I think it's a waiver of defenses, including statutory defenses, when you enter a guilty plea. I'm going to go back to what we said on brief. There were multiple items enumerated, and the term in the amended indictment was items.
In the proffer of evidence, the Commonwealth mentions the items stolen, but the only thing it mentions as far as the defendant being in possession of is the TV, and specifically says this, I guess, is the only proof of value, is that he bought it for $250. Now the Commonwealth wants to impose upon him restitution for the property stolen by someone else.
But I think you have to... And again, remembering that with a guilty plea, you've got a waiver to defenses, including to the sufficiency of the evidence, you have to look at the entire proffer here, which includes not only the items, it includes the fact that the date in question was the date of the burglary, not the date when the search warrant was executed, first of all. You've also got, in this particular case, the unique fact that, at least the suggestion, that the defendant was the perpetrator. At one point, the Commonwealth says, because he's pleading guilty, we're not going to get into some things, and also there is at least this reference to the white SUV that was on the video, and then a vehicle similar in description when the officers executed the search warrant at the defendant's house. So,
well, Mr. Jeffrey, even if we accept your proposition that this is a sort of offense for which restitution in the abstract can be ordered, doesn't restitution have to have some relationship to the facts of the case or to the to the record in the case? And here, I understand the litany of all the items that were allegedly taken, but the Commonwealth's proffer seems to suggest that the defendant in this case is only accused, and he's only pleading guilty to receiving a single item of stolen property. So assuming the restitution is appropriate at all, wouldn't it be limited to the $250 or at least whatever the trial court set the fair market value to be for the both single item that he admitted receiving as stolen property?
I guess I have a couple of responses to that. I'm sorry, I want to look at the statutory language on that really quickly that Judge Petty just alluded to. There's language, which conviction was had.
Well, I'm looking at 30, if it helps, I'm looking at 19.2305.2. The court, when ordering restitution pursuant to 305.1, may require that such defendant in the case of an offense resulting in damage, which we don't have here, I don't think, or loss or destruction of property of a victim, to either return the property to the owner, if the return of the property is impractical or impossible, pay an amount equal to the greater of the value of the property at the time of the offense or the value of the property at the time of sentencing. I mean, it seems to me that's the limitation on the amount, at least.
And 303 has the terminology by the offense for which convicted, and that's similar to the other statutes.
And the Virginia Supreme Court has pretty much adopted that language as being the rule statement for the case. In Howell versus Commonwealth, it cited a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it says that. The actual damages or loss suffered by the defendant to limit the damages or loss which a defendant can be ordered to repay to, quote, those which were directly caused by the offense.
Okay. And I would agree with the court, because I looked at those statutes very quickly, or not very quickly, I looked at them as preparing for the argument, and I think that's right. What you've got in this proffer here is the things that I just mentioned a minute ago. What I would take issue with is the suggestion that he's just pleading to the television set. I think I draw that in part from the date and the circumstances that were described in the proffer, and the fact, I don't think the fact that he was the only one he was in possession of 10 days or so later indicates the Commonwealth was trying to constrain that proffer in any fashion. Now, the defendant may have thought that.
Well, can you point to where in the proffer that limitation is? Because
which limitation?
The lack of limitation, I guess, is really what I'm asking about. The proffer is that all these items were stolen.
Correct.
And that he's found in possession of the TV, and that he's pleading guilty to receiving stolen property. Now, the receiving stolen property amended indictment doesn't say to wit the television or whatever.
Correct.
Words to that effect. So the question, it seems to me, is what is he pleading guilty to receiving stolen property for? The Commonwealth's proffer would seem to only support that the only item he received was the television. And if I'm wrong about that, tell me where the Commonwealth's proffer indicates that he actually received more than that as by way of stolen property.
I don't think there's an express indication in the proffer to that effect. And again, remembering that this was a guilty plea, it was part of a plea agreement. Admittedly, the only thing that the Commonwealth found him in actual possession of was the television set. My point is, I don't think there's any indication that the Commonwealth intended to so limit it. And
well, the Commonwealth clearly could have included full restitution as a part of the plea offer it made, and it didn't do that.
It's not express. I don't think there's even a written agreement. That's a fact that I'm stuck with. And
let me
ask me, could it have been done better? I think the answer is yes.
Let me change the facts here just a little bit and see what your response is. Suppose there was absolutely no suspicion that the defendant was the actual thief, but he was found several days later in possession of one item of property that was stolen. Would your argument be the same? Would you, at that point, be able to impose upon the defendant restitution for all the property stolen?
I think it would be weaker. I think one of the factors that we didn't discuss on brief, and I haven't discussed yet this morning, that you have to remember, and I guess your hypothetical kind of presupposes that these charges aren't there, but remember, this was part of a plea agreement. Several charges, including the firearm larceny, were dealt with, dismissed because of this plea agreement. And there was never any effort to withdraw the guilty plea. I mean, I think that's part of it. The defendant wanted the benefit of this bargain.
Well, normally, in an indictment, if the indictment isn't specific enough, you can ask for a bill of particulars.
Correct.
And that wasn't done. But the original indictment, of course, is... charges the theft of a number of objects. The problem is the amended indictment, which is what we have, and it sort of renders everything else, it seems to be, a nullity. We can't really consider that for which he was not convicted and that for which he did not plead guilty, it seems to me. So we have in the abstract this amended indictment, which has no specificity to it other than using the plural word items.
Right.
And coupling that with the proffer, which was uncontested at the time, which says that a number of items were stolen, but the proffer doesn't indicate that they were stolen by the defendant in this case, the appellant in this case, but that he is in fact pleading guilty to receiving stolen property, and the proffer includes a specific item that he was found in possession of, to with the TV. So I think the question then for us is, if you accept the proposition, and maybe you don't, I don't know, but if you accept the proposition that an order of restitution has to bear some resemblance to the actual loss that was involved in the charge, then how do we interpret all of this? And if the trial court exceeds its authority by ordering restitution for items that have no relationship to the crime for which the defendant is pleading guilty, I think the Commonwealth, in the absence of an agreement, a plea agreement that it would include those things, I suspect you'd have to agree that it would be inappropriate for the court to order that.
We don't have a plea agreement here, but what we do have is there's a reduced charge. There's obviously a great bit of consideration here.
Not a reduced charge.
Well, I'm sorry.
It's an amended charge. It's the same the same punishment.
I'm sorry.
It's not a lesser-included offense.
I misspoke. An amended offense on one, and three indictments are dismissed as a result.
Yeah, and what do we make of the fact that the Commonwealth nolprost the charge of larceny of a firearm and then wants to impose restitution on the defendant for stealing that same gun?
I don't think you make anything of it. People get bargains all the time. And part of my position is, if this was such a manifest injustice, he could have moved to withdraw this guilty plea. It seems to me he wants the benefit of this. And frankly, I think under some fairly recent case law, if this thing unravels, there's some question as to whether he could be reindicted on everything.
I think your point would be well taken if we had a plea agreement here.
I agree.
You're asking us to sort of presume that there is a quid pro quo here, which the defendant, accepted and should then, not get the benefit of. But none of that is reflected in the record. I mean, we're for all we know, the Commonwealth decided we got the wrong guy here. The best we got on this guy is receiving stolen property, and they amended the indictment accordingly. And to suggest that he's actually the thief, when nothing suggests that, because the Commonwealth didn't, there's no plea agreement that would acknowledge that although he is alleged to be criminally responsible, we're allowing him to, we're accepting this deal, and by the way, he needs to pay restitution as a result of that. None of that exists in this case.
Well, I am mindful of one of the things you said to an attorney earlier during the writ panels about equally susceptible and things of that nature. If you read that proffer, I mean, part of what it seems to me is that the Commonwealth, they certainly knew they could put him in possession of the one. And again, I guess I'm going to try to rely on your sort of practical knowledge of these things. Sometimes as a prosecutor, you realize that there's a certain active sentence you're looking for, and you might be able, probably going to be able to accomplish that with a plea to one, and maybe not have to go to the trouble of putting on a case where it may be shaky. There's all kinds of reasons. I think if we start speculating as to what might have been going on here, it's going to be difficult to really get to any firm answer. But what ultimately happened here, and again, it was in the victim impact statement. The court can rely on that, which I guess is really not responsive to your main concern, is was this the offense charged? And I can only go back to the proffer, Judge Humphreys. I don't have a plea agreement, obviously. I reviewed this brief when it was written, and I had marginal notes, I think, two or three times in the brief. When are you going to talk about the plea agreement? So I'm very mindful of that issue, and there's nothing there.
Well, obviously, I think you recognize the slippery slope here for us, which is, as prosecutors, if you don't have the evidence, you don't require a defendant to plead. Ethically, you're not supposed to be doing that. So, in the absence of a plea agreement, the only assumption I can make is a prosecutor recognized that they didn't have a case here for larceny, but they did have a case for receiving stolen property and amended the charge accordingly. And in the absence of a plea agreement that would suggest otherwise, that's the only conclusion I could reasonably draw here. The prosecutor acted according to their ethical mandate and reduced the charge to what they thought the evidence supported without any consideration otherwise.
I see my time has expired.
If that's a question, you may answer it, but your time has expired.
If you'd like a response, I can try. I think it's going to be akin to the other things I've said to you earlier. Repeating myself and wishing yet again that we had a written plea agreement. I would just in closing indicate that I think there was substantial consideration, and the defendant could have withdrawn this plea if he didn't want to avail himself of the package deal and didn't choose to do so. And I would ask you to affirm.
Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Harold, you have your rebuttal time remaining.
Thank you.
Mr. Harold, could I start off with asking you about Mr. Jeffers' last comment? In order to preserve this, or at least make it an issue, didn't you have a responsibility to move to withdraw your guilty plea as it being because the court's sentence was in violation of the terms of the agreement?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. It seems to me what the Commonwealth is saying is, if you want the benefit of this agreement, and it was a great agreement, it ended up with the defendant serving, I think he got 4 months in jail, active time. That's a great benefit to the defendant in this case, and he recognized that. But is the Commonwealth not saying, and I think the Commonwealth had good reason for offering us that particular type of agreement, because as the court suggested, they knew they didn't have a case.
Does your argument come down to the trial court, by imposing this restitution, violated the terms of the plea agreement because the plea agreement didn't require it?
I think that the judge's decision violated sentencing rules. Do we have to withdraw and give up the benefit of our agreement because we're not willing to accept being made to pay restitution for something not related to what we plead guilty to?
Well, I guess my question is, was there a plea agreement in this case?
I don't think that there was what you would call a plea agreement. I think in the final analysis, I know it was no written plea agreement. In the final analysis, as we approached trial, the Commonwealth knew what it had in terms of evidence. Now, I know it said somewhere in here that the Commonwealth said that there are other circumstances that point toward the defendant. But then again, the Commonwealth refused to disclose those circumstances. That's something that the Commonwealth pointed out in its brief. But the point is that we decided that we need to dismiss all these charges, let him plead guilty to just the charge of receiving stolen property, because that's supported by the evidence. We did find the TV.
Your argument, I take it, that the Commonwealth came in and, recognizing it couldn't prove those offenses on its own, dropped several charges and amended the indictment to receiving stolen property, and that once the Commonwealth did that, the defendant saw the light and on his own chose to plead guilty. That would have to be your argument, wouldn't it, that there was no plea agreement?
Well, saw the light. I think that that's what he thought. That's what we thought all along would be a fair disposition of this case. And that's why we had argued for this, and the Commonwealth finally agreed with us. And that's why we entered the plea of guilty, because he did, in fact, have the television. Now, I would say also, Judge, if I may, one thing that concerns me is this indictment, and it said that he was in possession of the stolen TV on February the 26th. Now, I have to take some responsibility for that. Now, the way this occurred...
You stole the TV?
Pardon?
You stole the TV?
No. I'm sorry. That's another mistake. No. That he was in possession of the stolen TV on that particular day. That's the date the offense occurred. And I think what the Commonwealth is doing is trying to extrapolate upon that and saying, well, you're saying you were there on February the 26th when all the other items were stolen. That's not what we intended to say when we pled guilty to that indictment. It should have said something other than February the 26th. It should have been more akin to the date that he claims he bought the television at a car wash. That, I would say, would be my fault. Also, probably because they've got items instead of one item in that amended order, motion to amend, the order to amend the indictment. That says items. That's not something that we really intended. And I think had I looked at it closer, I would have been able to discern that.
Well, I think the problem I have, at least, is that both of you are asking us to read a lot of things into the record that just aren't in the record.
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, and I think that this could have been cured by a bill of particulars. if we had actually sought a bill of particulars to be more specific in the indictment, then probably we wouldn't be at least having this argument today, because it was not specified. And I would think that we would have to take responsibility for that. I say both me and the Commonwealth. But I think what our intent was clear, to plead guilty only to the offense which authorized the court to order restitution as for which he stands convicted, which is receiving stolen property, which is, i.e., the television, $250, as opposed now. I think it's elementary that the court has, trial court has, broad discretion, unlimited discretion. I don't think it's unlimited. And I think in this particular case, the court went beyond its discretion in ordering that this $1,500 restitution be paid, $1,500 plus, as opposed to just the amount of the television, which is what the intent was to plead guilty to, Alford plea or otherwise. I would ask the court to remand this case for a new sentencing hearing or on the issue of restitution, not necessary to reverse the conviction. I don't think we want the conviction reversed
well,
at this point.
It's on that last point, if we remand this for resentencing, is the court obligated to impose the same active sentence that he imposed before?
I can't say that the court is obligated, but I think the court
would. You might get more time out of this.
Judge, I'm sorry. Judge Williams, the trial court judge, has been on the bench for over 25 years. I know him very well. I would take that risk, quite frankly.
Hey, you would roll the dice.
I would roll the dice.
Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We're going to greet counsel, and then we're going to take a 10-minute recess.